Welcome to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, we gonna try to mow all the way through the rest of Exodus, or are we gonna give it a shot anyway?
We are gonna give it a shot. Yeah, I've already shifted from first to second to third gear, so I mean I'm already moving. So I think by the time we get talking, we're gonna cover some territory this morning. In fact, there's a couple chapters where we're just gonna say, yeah, we already talked about that, and then jump to the next. So there's a good chance that in about 39 and a half more minutes that we will be wrapping up.
What you didn't prepare for, though, is the infamous Daniel Price bunny trail.
Yeah. That's all right. Maybe we can jump down a couple of very shallow bunny holes. We'll see. If it doesn't happen, there's always next episode. That's the goal anyway.
All right. Well, you know what? Let's try to make it happen. So let's just jump right in.
All right, let's do it. So last time we talked about a lot, actually, about the face of Moses, his shining face that he had when he came down from Mount Sinai, and he spoke to the people with his veil off. And then when he was done, he put it back down. And when he went in to talk to God, he lifted the veil up, so that anytime he had either a face-to-face talk with God or a face-to-face talk with the people relaying the words of God to them, then the veil was up. Otherwise, in his day-to-day activities, it was down. And we talked about that in connection with 2 Corinthians and how Paul makes use of that particular story. So that took us to the end of chapter 34. So that leaves us with chapters 35 through 40, which seems like, of course, a huge amount of material. But as we'll see in just a second, a lot of this is basically replaying what we've already heard in the previous chapters. So here's what happens in chapter 35. Chapter 35 is a pretty easy chapter to summarize. So Moses gets everybody together, and he basically says, hey, here's what God told us to do. You're going to have a Sabbath. That's the way he starts out. And then he goes on to say, basically, here are all the materials that we need to build God's tent. And he starts to list them, beginning with around verse 5, something like that. We need precious metals like gold, silver, bronze. We need all kinds of material for tent making, like the blue, the purple, the scarlet material. We need some animal hides. We need oil. We need spices. We need precious stones. And anyway, he goes through this long list, basically a shopping list, if you will, of everything that they need, except, of course, there's no shopping that's going to take place. This is all going to come from the people themselves. So when we get to verse 21, we have this description of how this worked. It said, everyone whose heart stirred him and everyone whose spirit moved him came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting, for all its service, and for the holy garments. And then it goes on to kind of delineate, to spell out more exactly who brought what, which groups brought which kind of materials. It talks about how, how every man brought this. And verse 25, the skilled women were involved with spinning some of this material. It says that the rulers, they brought the precious stones. And then verse 29 kind of sums it all up. It says the Israelites, all the men and women whose heart moved them to bring material for all the work which the Lord had commanded through Moses to be done, they brought a freewill offering to the Lord. And then the chapter wraps up basically by saying who was in charge. We've heard these names before, Bezalel and Aholiab. They were the artisans. They were the ones that were skillful in putting together all of this stuff into the tabernacle. So basically chapter 35 tells us, here's what we need, and here's all the people who brought what was needed. And then these are the two people who are in charge of it. Now, one of the things I like about this chapter that really stands out to me is basically you've got Israel, who are just on the flip side of near destruction. I mean, this is, you got to keep this context in mind. These people are coming from the golden calf debacle. Man, this is all fresh. It's not like, you know, a year has passed. This is just days after everything went down with that. So God has spared them. God has forgiven them. God has given them a fresh new start. And Moses says, hey, this is what we need. And so the people, in response that God has showered upon them, then turn around and contribute all of this for the making of God's house. And the funny thing about this is that it's not like Moses gave very specific instructions to individuals or to certain groups as to what they must do, and said all of this was given as a free will offering. In fact, in chapter 36, it's called a free will offering. So all of this, the people contributed with a willing spirit, with a free heart, because they had seen the grace of God shown to them in the midst of their rebellion and sin and everything that happened with their idolatry, which is a great example of how it's the love of God that prompts good works. It's the love of God that leads to our contributions. And it's not just kind of this naked obedience to some sort of mandate. Instead, it's a response to what God has done for us.
Yeah, it shows you that the motivation or the ability behind doing this was not the giving of the command itself, but in response to the grace of God. So God can give the command, which he did, and you get some law and you go down there and there's some golden calf stuff going on. That's how that works. In the midst of law giving, there's idolatry. But after forgiveness, you actually see a little bit of obedience.
Yeah.
And that's how that works.
That's how that works. Yeah. In fact, chapter 36, the next chapter, opens up with, I think it's kind of a humorous episode, because the people respond to the love of God. They were going overboard. 36 starts out with seven verses which describe how the two artists, Bezalel and his friend, they're you know, material from the people, and they're putting it all together. They're organizing work crews. They're overseeing the construction of the tabernacle. And people keep bringing more and more stuff. They have to call Moses. And this is verse 5 of 36. And they tell Moses basically, hey, you got to tell the people to stop. People are bringing much more than enough for the construction work which the Lord commanded us to perform. So not only did the people respond freely and willingly to the grace that was shown to them, they responded so much to where, you know, eventually the guys are like, hey, we have way more than enough. We could build like, you know, five tabernacles with all the stuff that you're bringing us. So thank you. But the offering plate is spilling over. We don't need any more money. Thank you. You can keep the rest. I'm sure that happens all the time in churches. We're not going to take an offering this Sunday because, you know, we've like maxed out of how much money we can put in the bank. We'll skip it this time around.
Oh man, yes.
That kind of over the top giving, I think, is such a beautiful expression of the thankfulness in response to the fact that God spared them, that he forgave them, that he promised he would still stick with them.
Yeah, somebody asked me once, they're like, not in the best, not with the best intentions, but like, do you believe in good works? And I was like, yeah, man. Like, in fact, I even do some on, like, after I like hear the gospel, sometimes I like stumble into one totally on accident.
Unplanned.
Like every once in a while, dude, like I'll just like end up doing something good, like because like a totally on accident. Like
yeah, it's funny the unreal accusations that are sometimes leveled against those who preach the gospel, as if good works aren't going to be the natural and unplanned outcome of the grace of God that's at work in your life.
Yeah, as if the Bible wasn't crystal clear that like love and service of neighbor is the fruit of grace.
Right. Yeah, that's, you know, trees produce fruit. Christians mm-hmm. produce good works. It's just what happens. It's not as if it's some great, you have to conceive some great plan or scheme for pulling this off. It's just the way the Christian life works. If you're a Christian, you're doing good works, period.
Yeah. And if you want people to love and serve one another, if you use the tree metaphor, which is what the Bible uses quite often, the rain of grace is much better at producing fruit than the acts of the law. That is the case.
Hey, that's a good tweet. That's very tweetable.
It's what the law is, man. It's a ministry of death. It's there to cut you down. Yeah, I understand. Maybe some people, maybe you might be like, well, the law will prune you back a little bit, and that'll help. Maybe. But ultimately, that thing's going to have to be watered. And that's going to be forgiveness and grace that does that.
Yeah. Needs a lot more water and sunshine than chainsaws.
Yeah. Indeed. All right, continuing on.
All right, continuing on. So that puts us through 36, verse 7. And then beginning from this point through the rest of 36, to the rest of 37, and through most of 38 and 39, we have a description of what we've already heard beginning back in chapter 25. So it starts, for instance, in 36, verse 8, we're talking about the curtains of the tabernacle that were made. And then it goes on to talk about the boards, which provided kind of the structure of the tent, as well as the walls that were surrounding the whole tabernacle court area. Then it moves to the veils, like, you know, you got a veil before the entrance of the court itself. You got another veil before the tent, the Holy of Holies, the entrance into the tent. And then, of course, you have the most well-known veil between the Holy Place and the Holy of Holies. And then it goes from there to describe the furnishings inside the Holy Place, the Ark, the Table of Showbread, the Table of Incense, and the golden lampstand, the menorah. You got that all talked about in 37. 38 goes on outside of the tent itself and moves to the courtyard to describe the altar and this wash basin made out of bronze that's between the tabernacle and the altar. And then the court itself, how it's made. And then at the end of 38, there's this summation of a lot of the metal that was contributed to make the tabernacle, the gold and the silver and the bronze. We have, I mean, very detailed descriptions of exactly how much was offered by the people to make this in, you know, measurements like shekels and talents and things of that nature. So that's through the end of 38. 39 is talking about the vestments of the priest, at least half of 39 is talking about the vestments of the priests, which again, we've already covered what they're made out of, the precious stones that are in the breastplate of Aaron. And then it finishes it out with the description of that golden plate that went across the forehead of Aaron that had the words "Holy to Yahweh" inscribed on it. And so that's the way this whole section goes. It's not the exact same order as we saw earlier with the instructions given to Moses. When Moses was first told about the tabernacle, God started with the most important parts, like the Ark of the Covenant. when it's described in these chapters, it's kind of a more practical approach. So you got the tent itself made, and then you talk about what goes inside the tent. But more or less, it's a description of exactly what they were able to accomplish with the material that was given to them. So I think in what, like 5 minutes, I've covered three chapters. That is a record. I just like to note that is the first time that has ever occurred after 100 and however many episodes of 40 minutes in the Old Testament.
That's pretty good. That's only because...
For a minute while I pat myself on the back.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens years and years and years from now. When we get through like 1st and 2nd Kings, and then we're hitting 1st and 2nd Chronicles, that'll probably be pretty quick. Like, and we just covered all this.
Yeah. Go back and listen to episodes 1554 and 1555. We talked about that there. Yeah, so we are now, if you're keeping track of this, we are now almost at the end of 39. And keep in mind, there's only 40 chapters in the book. So here's what happens in the last chapter and a half. One of the main things that we're going to see is that Moses is going to use language that sounds very familiar to us. It's sometimes an allusion, sometimes almost a direct quote from some of the very first episodes of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, way back in Genesis 1 and 2. I've mentioned this more than once, but I'm going to kind of bring some of it together as we talk about this last chapter and a half of how the whole description of the tabernacle is patterned after the creation account. Very, not only in the language that's used, but also the structure of the retelling of how the tabernacle was made. So I'll get to that in just a minute. But here's, let me kind of quickly summarize what happens in this last chapter and a half. So beginning with verse 32 of chapter 39, it says that all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting was completed. And it says that the Israelites did everything just as the Lord had commanded Moses. That becomes also a refrain that we hear throughout these chapters, that everything was made exactly as God had commanded Moses, so that the people were not just kind of coming up with something on their own. They weren't being creative. They weren't interjecting their own ideas or opinions into this. This was all made according to the instructions that God had given to Moses. And of course, that makes sense because this is God's house. You know, if my wife and I are going to build a home and we meet with the architect and say we're going to build a 4-bedroom home and it's, going to have this size kitchen and this size family room and maybe a study and all of this. So we meet with the architect, we plan out with him in great detail what we want it to look like. And the patterns drawn up, the blueprints, everything like that. Well, that's when, once the construction begins, of course, that is exactly what we want to happen. We don't want the architect to come in and say, you know what, I'm going to make this a 3-bedroom home. And it won't be a study, and it's going to be a really small kitchen, but a huge, huge family room. No, it's not up to him. It's up to those who will inhabit the house. It's up to me and my wife. Well, it's kind of like that here with God. He gives the blueprint. He is the architect. He spells out in detail what he wants his home to look like, to be like, how many rooms, dimensions, decorations, everything. And it's up to the people to build it exactly as God had commanded, because every single aspect of God's home is important. Important not just because it's his, but important because in one way or another, every aspect of his home tells us something about him. And it tells us something about how he interacts with his people. Because ultimately, God's home is really not so much for him as it is for his visitors, for his guests, for his family, because this is going to be a home where he meets his people. It's a very social, the tabernacle is a very social home, very social house, because God is always inviting people in. And they're doing this, they're doing that, in order that God might have this kind of ongoing interaction with his family, with the Israelites. So that's one of the key themes that you see in this closing part of Exodus, is that they made everything just the way God told them to make it. So part of that is spelled out in the last part of 39. And it wraps up, the closing verse of chapter 39 is this: Moses saw all the work, and behold, they had done it. Just as the Lord had commanded, this they had done. So Moses blessed them. We're going to come back to that verse in a minute, but to kind of keep that language in mind. But that's the way the chapter ends. Then chapter 40, the final chapter, takes us through the kind of the setting up of everything. And this happens, the second verse tells us, this all happens on the first day of the first month. So this is the beginning of the year. This is not January 1st, but the beginning of the year for the Israelites. First day, first month, everything is going to be set up. And so they do, and it goes on in the next few verses, describe how everything is erected. They put the ark in there. They set up the veil, the tent, everything like that. And then they take anointing oil, beginning with verse 9. And this anointing oil is put over basically everything. It goes on the tabernacle, it goes on the furnishings, it goes on the altar. And then after everything has been anointed, then they get Aaron and his sons, who are going to be the priest, and they anoint them. They wash them, they put on their holy garments, their vestments, and then they anoint Aaron, and then they anoint his sons so that they will serve as the priests there. So everything is set up on the first day, on the first month. And then verse 17 through 33 goes through once more. We have this repetition that they did everything just as the Lord had commanded Moses. In fact, seven times we have the exact same phrase that they did this just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And then they did that just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So that takes us through verse 33. And then at the end, the closing section, 34 through 38, describes what happens after everything is set up, after everything is anointed, after sacrifices are offered. Then God comes into his home. Then the cloud of God covers the tent. The glory of the Lord fills the tent. And that becomes his abode in Israel. So that's kind of a really quick overview of what's coming up in this last chapter and a half. Now, what I want to do is back up just a little bit and kind of summarize as much as I can how this particular structure is patterned after what happens Genesis 1 and 2, and why it is, because that's the big question. Why would so much of the tabernacle language be taking us back to Genesis 1 and 2? And there's two or three things that I want to focus on. One is that you see over and over this pattern of seven. So I don't remember if we talked about this when we covered Genesis 1 or not, but you got patterns of seven all over the first chapter of Genesis. To begin with, the very first verse of the Bible, the opening words are seven in number. There's seven words in Genesis 1, verse 7 Hebrew words in Genesis 1, verse 1. And then, of course, you've got seven times God says that what he had done is good or very good. So seven words in the opening verse, seven times God says it's good or very good. And of course, then you have 7 days in the week. which culminates on the Sabbath day. So all of that is Genesis 1. Got four different aspects of the sevenness of the creation account. Well, that's exactly what you see in the tabernacle creation account as well. So to begin with, the instructions on how to build the tabernacle begins on the seventh day. And then these instructions, which take us from chapter 35 through 31, are comprised of seven speeches that God gives to Moses about how to make this. And the seventh speech culminates in a discussion of the Sabbath. So you have the same kind of pattern going on here. You got sevens all over Genesis 1. You have sevens all over the last few chapters of Genesis. So that's one of the ways that you can see what happens in creation is being replicated in the making of the tabernacle. But then you've got these echoes of scriptural verses between these two. Just let me give you a couple of illustrations. So Genesis 1, verse 31 says, God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Now, Exodus 39, which we just read a few minutes ago, said that Moses saw all the work, and behold, they had done it. This saw everything that he had made and saw all the work, and behold, all of that is almost verbatim in the Hebrew. Then Genesis 2, back to Genesis 2, back to creation, it says, thus the heavens and the earth were finished. Then back to Exodus 39, it says, all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting was finished. And then jumping back to Genesis 2, it said, God blessed the seventh day. And then in Exodus 39, after the tabernacle was made, it said, God blessed them, the Israelites. So you've got all of these parallels that go on between Genesis and Exodus, between the making of the heavens and the earth, and then the making of the tabernacle. Well, the question is why? Everything that I've read in the commentaries and in various scholarly literature basically agrees that what Moses does in his description of the tabernacle is meant to take us back to Genesis 1 and 2. Well, why is that? Well, the simple answer is this: because in the midst of a fallen world where everything is not as it should be, in the midst of sin and brokenness and pollution and guilt and shame and everything else, in a world that lost the original Eden, that lost paradise, that lost this pure and perfect relationship with God, in the midst of a world like that, along comes the tabernacle that is like a new Eden for the Israelites. So they are able to come to the tabernacle, to come to God into a place that is very much like a new creation, because it's here in the tabernacle where God dwells, where he has his blood and sacrifices and the giving of holiness and purity. It's there that God is constantly reconstituting his people, recreating them, making them to be the way that he wants them to be, basically restoring them to the created humans that he wants them to be. No longer filled with pollution and sin, but purified and forgiven. Those who are at one with the God who loves them, who created them, and who now has restored them. So that's why, long description, but that's why I think that's so important, because the tabernacle then becomes the place of an ongoing Eden where God dwells among his people. And at the same time then, it becomes the preview of what God is going to do in the true new creation that we have in Christ, because all of this is purposely designed to point toward its fulfillment in the Word becoming flesh, in the incarnation, in the new tabernacle, in the new temple, in Christ, who makes us all new creations in himself. So you have this journey from creation to the tabernacle to the incarnation. And every step along the way is God working to make us or remake us into the people that he wants us to be. And the tabernacle is one more illustration of that desire.
Yeah,
I've been talking way too long.
No, it's good. That is good. I think it's interesting that just like in Eden as well, he sets people in it to tend to it, right? So Eden is not sort of this thing where man is just kind of roaming around, like wondering what he's going to do, and you know, he's just worshiping God all day long. That's not how it works. You know, man is set in the garden to tend it. That's what he's doing. That's why it's a garden, because even in Eden, gardens need tending, which tells you that having something to do is a good thing. That mm-hmm. work, even in the that work was part of the original plan. It's difficult and broken now. It doesn't work for us.
Thorns and thistles now, right?
Yeah, but then it was a very good thing. Tending the garden was a blessing, not part of the curse. And so in the tabernacle, as it mirrors Eden, it's not as though God says build this place and then just, you know, leave it there. I'll chill out in there, and then, you know, you guys can come be in my presence every once in a while. But puts people in there to tend to what God has created. And I think that also tells us something about the ultimate new creation, that there'll be some of that going on too, that we'll have things to do. And they'll be good things. They're not burdensome things, not things that we don't desire to do, but that work, it's one of the things that I think that sometimes our depictions of Eden or even heaven are like, what do you do? You know, it sounds kind of boring. You know, am I really just going to be like on my face for like ever? Because I mean, I'm sure God's pretty glorious, but that sounds like eventually, you know, eventually it's going to get pretty old. And the answer to that is no. I think you have lots to do. I think that they're like, I'm really looking forward to work being redeemed. So that we're able to do the things that we are meant to do in ways that actually work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably one of the main misconceptions that people have of what the afterlife is going to be like. That either we're just, you know, laying around on clouds or on our face worshiping God. This is a new creation. It's a new heavens and a new earth. And we're going to be there not as souls, but as people who are perfected in body, resurrected bodies. And so we're going to be doing things with our bodies. We're going to be playing. We're going to be working. We're going to be eating and drinking and doing all those things that are part of being a creature, part of having flesh and blood, resurrected and glorified flesh and blood, but flesh and blood nonetheless.
Yeah, well, it's part of being made in the image of God. I mean, God is not a God who doesn't do. God does.
Yeah, he's constantly working. He's so we who are his image mirror that.
Yeah, but work is part of purposeful work. Work with a reason behind it, a good reason, is part of what it means to be made in the image of God. God, by virtue of making us, did something. And then we are created and we do things. It's part of the reason why, kind of going back to even talking about doing good works. What is good works? It's good work. It's what it is. It's that's what good works are. They're work that is good. And mm-hmm. Part of the new creation, even that we have now, of being new creatures, baptized into Christ and a new creation is born, part of that new creation, that redeemed creation, it does because it's part of what it's made for. It's part of what is it's innate in it. It's part of what it means to be like God, is to do. And so the question is never, I wonder if what God created will do. Well, if he created it, he creates things to do. He creates everything that he's created will work for good. And so that you don't have to wonder if, I've been baptized into Christ and now I'm a new creation. I wonder if I'll just sit around and not do anything. No, that's not how that works.
Yeah.
Adam did, like God did. That's how it goes.
Yeah. So we can look forward to, to the resurrection with, knowing that on our best days in this life, it's but a faint image of the goodness that we're going to enjoy there. And part of that goodness will be activity, labor, blessed and enjoyable labor.
Yeah. I think that's why you feel, sometimes it's very elusive because the world is broken, but everyone knows what that feeling is like when you do, and this doesn't have to do with even necessarily doing what most people would consider good things. I'm not talking about, feeding the hungry or something like that, which obviously are good things. But even when you do something that would seem somewhat mundane, when you finish something that you set out to do, when you feel like you've done a good job, there is what I would consider a holy sense of accomplishment. That's not wrong. There is a sense of completion to something that is good and right. And that feeling is fairly elusive to us. I don't think we experience that as much as we're meant to, because we fail at doing things well so often. But every once in a while, you do something that is halfway decent and you complete it, and you do feel good about it. You're like, man, I set out to do this thing. It was difficult, maybe it was hard, and the harder it was, the more sense of accomplishment you have afterwards. And you say, that was good. I don't know. It's like writing books, difficult process. But when you finish it, there is this sense of, oh, I did something. I made something. I created something. I think that just all gets amped up in the new creation, that you'll have things to do. And like that sense of accomplishment, that sense of fulfilling something, doing something, completing something is something that I think that we'll experience a whole lot. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. It gives a foretaste of what is to come. We're sneaking up on our time allotment here. Let me wrap up with a description of what takes place at the very end. So verse 34 says, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." We've seen this exact same thing happen on Mount Sinai. The cloud comes down and the glory of the Lord is there. So just like the tabernacle is a place of new creation, so it's also going to be a portable Sinai, this place of revelation, this place where the word of God is given. The glory that fills it is so intense that Moses can't even enter the tabernacle. And it says throughout their journeys, when the cloud came up from the tabernacle, the Israelites would take off. They would follow where God led them. And then when it was on the tabernacle, that's where they stayed. It was a cloud by day and a fire in it by night. And so the tabernacle became the abode of God, his house, his place, sort of almost you could think of it as his body, if you will, in a metaphorical sort of way. This is where they knew he had located himself, just like he would eventually, in reality, become flesh, become a body, and tabernacle among us in Christ. And ultimately, that's what all of Exodus is pointing us toward, is the Messiah fulfilling everything that is sketched out for us here. So he is the color of which this is the black and white prototype. So that's the end of Exodus. Hope everybody's enjoyed it.
Dude, that finished. That is it. And I'll tell you what, I think that Leviticus is going to be quite the adventure.
It will. Yeah, yeah. Hang on to your hats, because Leviticus might be more than you initially bargained for.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be interesting for me and you to get out of narrative for a little while. And one time I did a Bible study on Leviticus. It turned out that it was really a Bible study on Leviticus and Hebrews. So I'm guessing right. that I'm guessing that Derek, I don't know, but we'll see. But I'm guessing that as we journey through Leviticus, that we will be in the New Testament more than average.
Yeah. We're gonna be working that Bible back and forth, flipping between these two quite a bit. I hope everyone's gonna enjoy it as much as I am. I'm looking forward to it. It is indeed one of the most Christ-saturated books of the Old Testament, and hopefully I'll be able to demonstrate that as we work our way through it.
All right. Well, Chad, thanks for hanging out. Thanks for working your way through two books.
You bet. It's been fun. Look forward to more.
Yeah, over the course of the last couple of years. Guys, hope you join us for Leviticus. That'll be next week. So until then, we'll see you later.